We're focusing today on the part of the Bible's creation narrative contained in Genesis 2. And the story is told of a painting of Adam and Eve enjoying the Garden of Eden before the fall that was being viewed by a group of three, a Briton, a Frenchman, and a citizen of the Soviet Union in the days of the Cold War. "Look at their reserve, their calm," says the Brit. "They must be English." "Nonsense," the Frenchman disagrees. "They're naked and so beautiful. Clearly they're French." "No way," the Russian points out. "They have no clothes and no shelter. They have only fruit to eat and are being told they live in paradise. Obviously they're living in the Soviet Union." And actually, for those who might want to follow up the geographical details of the chapter, one of the most convincing views as to where the author might be aiming to set this account locates it, well, only just outside the old Soviet Union in the Armenian highlands of Turkey. The first question most of us in reading this account want to settle, though, is whether or not focusing on that kind of geographical detail is a good focus to have. What kind of writing is this, after all? How are we meant to understand the exact historical status of the chapter? A good many people, a good many Christians, simply see it as a myth. To some, a worthless myth. To others, a piece of writing which nonetheless gives some wise general lessons for life, like Aesop's fables, perhaps. Others at the opposite end of the spectrum view this and all of the early Genesis chapters as documenting in print something that could, in principle, have been recorded on video in exactly the way it's described. I recognise I'm probably not, in 3 minutes flat, likely to overturn those with a settled conviction in either of those directions. My understanding, though, is that the type of writing we have here is best seen as somewhere in between those two poles. I want to move at least a little away from the 100% literal understanding, partly because I don't think it's in the nature of serpents or snakes to actually talk. God could make them do so, but it seems that kind of detail may be better understood as a metaphorical way of describing a human being tempted from without, most likely by the devil, although though the serpent could be seen to represent some other kind of external force. And there's clear precedent for seeing at least one other part of the Bible communicating in that kind of way. Revelation chapter 12, which describes the devil's action, again in terms of some kind of serpent or dragon, in that case being pictured as trying to physically devour the Christ child as soon as he is born. In that chapter, Revelation 12, I think it's pretty clear we're not meant to see that there was a malevolent dragon roaming the streets of Bethlehem and poking his nose through the stable door, but rather that that's being used as an image to describe the underlying spiritual forces that were behind Herod's unsuccessful attempts to get rid of Jesus in his very earliest years. And I suggest a similar way of understanding the picture of the serpent's temptation in Genesis chapter 3. Now, some conclude from that what's being described in graphic terms in Genesis 2 and 3 is simply a very vivid way of picturing the kind of process that happens to every human being at some point in their lives, most probably in their early years. In their view, seeing it as a description of the innocence and perfection of each newborn human being, which inevitably at some point is going to be spoiled as we're tempted to sin. To my mind, though, that doesn't really work as an interpretation of these chapters, and particularly of Genesis 2, because of what's said again later in the Bible, this time in Romans chapter 5. That chapter speaks first to the representative role of Christ's redemption in saving his followers, and then Christ's representative role in rescuing us is closely paralleled with the representative role of Adam's sin in causing our problems in the first place. And to my mind, to take what that chapter says seriously, the human race needs to have a single point of origin, a first man, or rather, a first couple. I'd add in passing, that isn't by any means considered impossible by geneticists either. There's a theory that there's what they call a mitochondrial Eve and her counterpoint, the Y chromosomal Adam. That's been doing the rounds for a good few years now. Whether or not we're meant to deduce from the Bible that the first man was actually called Adam and the woman Eve, or whether those are labels added to make their representative roles clear, I'm not entirely sure. Whether we're meant to understand that there was an actual tree and an actual apple, similarly to me, that's not that important, because they stand for something far, far bigger. The way in which God puts limits on what human beings are and aren't allowed to do, which we transgress at our peril. On any understanding of the way in which Genesis 2 is speaking to us, though, a Christian can surely not discount its importance. To begin with, because of its place as one of the foundational chapters of the scriptures, and in addition, because of the way in which Jesus and the other New Testament writers refer to it on more than one occasion. And I want to suggest three key areas we need to hear this chapter's message if we're to understand, well, first of all, the God who made us and the world we live in. Secondly, the work that's entrusted to us. And last but not least, the relationship between the sexes. So first of all, what Genesis 2 says about the God who made us. And we see here very much a good God. A God who is well able to create a good place, a perfect place for his human creatures to live in. And who, though he grants them freedom, nonetheless expects them to live within certain parameters. For what I'm presenting as my first teaching point, that's got quite a few clauses, I'm aware, because Genesis 2, despite being no more than a few paragraphs long, has a great deal of foundational importance to communicate about the God who made us. As is the case with the complementary account of the 7 days of creation in the preceding chapter, Genesis 1, you'll notice there isn't an array of competing gods, but only one divine will. That might seem obvious to us, but actually in the ancient world and in quite significant portions of the world today, that's making quite a significant point. And what God creates is good. Genesis 1 has spelled that out by explicitly repeating the same phrase at the end of each day. In chapter 2, that's clear from the description of Eden as a garden, well watered and containing all kinds of plants that are good for food. Adam and Eve are told that they are all given for them to eat, though there's a restriction, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is off limits. And the exact meaning of those words isn't that straightforward. It's much debated. It's clear, though, there's a far bigger issue at stake than steering clear of a particular variety of fruit. It's something to do with their being willing to obey what God says is and isn't acceptable and right, of God's ultimately deciding what's good and what's evil, and not us human beings. Next up, the passage has significant things to say about what God made the human race for. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and keep it. In other words, we've been appointed custodians of creation. Every living species has some kind of effect on the rest of the planet, some quite a big effect, but only the human race is aware of the influence we have on the world around us. Only we can therefore choose to decide how we behave. what the environmental scientists say about how we're in danger of spoiling our world may be inconvenient, but faithful believers surely can't just ignore their warnings. Note from the same verse as well, it's God's intention that Adam is put to work. The Lord could, I guess, have made a garden, a world in which it didn't need any tending, but Genesis 3 points out how after the fall, some aspects of work that human beings need to do are now regrettably particularly onerous. That's a bit of a qualification. But work in itself is very definitely pictured in Genesis 2 as part of God's good creation. That doesn't just mean paid work, of course. But whilst we can make a constructive contribution to the world around us, to the people around us, it doesn't do anyone any good to be idle. Finally, some brief comments about what the second half of Genesis 2 says about the relationship between the sexes. When I did a series of sermons about marriage a few years ago, the first of them was based on this chapter, for the simple reason that when Jesus was asked a thorny question about marriage, he immediately based his answer on Genesis 2. From Matthew's Gospel, Jesus answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh." Jesus adding, "What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." Those words form quite a significant basis for the Christian response to all kinds of questions about marriage and relationships. I'm going to sketch out what they say in relation to just three of those issues. First of all, the goodness of the sexual relationship between a husband and a wife. That needs to be said because sometimes people have taken Christianity to be saying, well, either that marriage is second best for those who can't cut it as celibate priests or monks or nuns, or that the attraction between the sexes is somehow suspect, or that sexual intercourse is solely for procreation and is best if any pleasure element is minimized or removed. Well, Genesis 2 points firmly away from those kind of ideas. You notice the man turns to poetry when he first sees the woman God has made for him. If you enjoy watching musicals, there's a certain style which is normal. Most of musicals, it's done with dialogue. But then when the emotion reaches a certain level, they generally turn to song. And often, as things get even more exciting, there's dance as well. And the same kind of feel to the way Genesis chapter 2 is working, as the prose of the majority of the chapter turns to poetry to give us Adam's response to Eve's creation. "This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." We sense Adam's joy, partly because through Eve there's the possibility not just of one other human being, but a whole host of human beings. But actually Genesis chooses not even to hint at that for another couple of chapters. The focus here is on the good that Eve herself brings, a helper fit for Adam, unlike the animals. The second issue I want to focus briefly on, and for that matter the third, relates to a hot-button issue for today in the way that the chapter emphasises the value of the opposite sexes in God's good plan for the human race. You'll be aware that an increasing number of people today report very serious psychological issues associated with the feeling that they were born in the wrong body, what's sometimes called gender dysphoria. It's become a very prominent issue in our media. And there are all kinds of different assumptions that shape the varied responses to it, including a few voices who view the existence of two sexes as an aspect of our biological development as a species that we do best to minimise and to blur, for whom the idea that there are two genders needs to be subverted and ideally, they say, in time, abolished. Well, leaving aside the question as to how best to help those facing very specific gender identity struggles, I'd say that as a starting point for any thinking in this kind of area, as Christians, we mustn't lose sight of the fact that though every aspect of our beings may well include problems for some, nonetheless, in principle at least, the creation of male and female is part of God's good plan. Then finally, a word about what's sometimes now grandly called polyamory, formalized multiple partner relationships, or their second cousin, open relationships. Or actually, in the case of some younger people, it isn't necessarily given such a grand title. There's just the presumption that sexual fidelity to a single partner is only one of many different options to choose between. Now, of course, the Old Testament knew quite a bit about one form of this, polygamy being quite a significant feature of Israel's early life. But the way the Bible begins seems very deliberately to make a clear statement that is not the divine plan. When Henry Ford and his wife celebrated their golden wedding anniversary, a reporter asked them, "To what do you attribute your 50 years of successful married life?" "The formula," replied Mr. Ford, "is the same formula I've always used in making cars. Just stick to the one model." I'm aware there are 101 questions all that raises. There's a lot more of the Bible that needs to be looked at. What's written in page 2 of our Bibles doesn't represent the last word. But nonetheless, Genesis 2 is, I believe, given by God to represent a very important first word, a foundation to our thinking in a whole multitude of areas that we discount at our peril. Amen.